WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of a man who has made our world much more dangerous, A.Q. Khan. He's a hero to many in his country, Pakistan, where he's considered the father of the country's bomb. He also created a private network that sold nuclear secrets and technology to any country willing to pay, including Iran, Libya, and North Korea. We'll talk with Gordon Carrera about his new book, Shopping for Bombs, the story of Khan, how he created what's been described as a Walmart of private sector proliferation, and how that's changed the world. Carrera is a security correspondent for the BBC. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Bob Dylan's new album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The former CIA director, George Tenet, reportedly described A.Q. Khan as at least as dangerous as Osama bin Laden, a label my guest Gordon Carrera says is richly deserved. Carrera is the author of a new book about Khan called Shopping for Bombs. Khan is a hero to many in Pakistan, where he's considered the father of the nuclear bomb. But he's responsible not only for developing nuclear capability in his country, he built a clandestine network selling nuclear secrets and technology across the globe to any country willing to pay, including Iran, Libya, and North Korea. Through his network, for the first time, nuclear products became available in the private sector, out of state control. Khan has been under house arrest in Pakistan since 2004, when he confessed to selling nuclear secrets. Over the weekend, he had surgery for prostate cancer. My guest, Gordon Carrera, is a security correspondent for the BBC TV and radio. I asked him to describe A.Q. Khan's nuclear network.
Towards its end, the network really was a globalized network. It had production points across the world, in Asia, in Malaysia, in South Africa, in Turkey, a hub in Dubai where material was routed through. This really was the globalization of nuclear technology sales, and represented really something very new and very dangerous, part of that trend towards transnational threats and transnational networks.
And he sold to governments and to terrorists, do we know?
We don't think he sold to terrorists. There's been a lot of concern about whether some of that technology he sold could have found its way to terrorists. Obviously, there's concern because he, of course, was based in Pakistan, a country which both has the nuclear bomb and has a lot of the Al-Qaeda leadership in there and a number of militants. There's no evidence of Khan himself directly dealing with Al-Qaeda or with terrorists himself. Other Pakistani scientists did from Pakistan's nuclear program.
What was A.Q. Khan's role in creating the Pakistan nuclear weapon?
Well, he played a really pivotal role. He came to Europe as a young scientist and got a job partly by chance at a European nuclear technology centre called Urenco. And just at that time, in the early 70s, Pakistan was making a new push towards developing a nuclear bomb, precisely because it felt threatened by India, felt it needed one for its own security. And Khan was absolutely vital in delivering that bomb to Pakistan. He wasn't the only person, but he was a vital part of that mission by stealing some of those plans from Europe, by delivering them to Pakistan, by building a global procurement network to bring together the parts for Pakistan's bomb. All of that was thanks to A.Q. Khan.
Now, early on in Khan's nuclear career, was he officially working with the Pakistan government?
Absolutely. He started off as an agent of the Pakistan government. He came to Europe as a young student, but while he was there in Europe, he became a spy and started stealing those plans. And that was done on the instructions of Pakistan's prime minister. Khan wrote him a letter saying, "I can help you." And the prime minister, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, said, "Go ahead and do it." So at that point, he was very much an agent of the Pakistani state. Went back, got a senior job in Pakistan's nuclear program in a very secretive plant, and was building the bomb for Pakistan.
How did he go freelance?
Well, he built that bomb for Pakistan, built the network to bring together the parts. And then in the 1980s, he makes this transition from a purchaser to a salesman, from importing the components into Pakistan to exporting them out to other countries. He basically twists the business network that he's built up from buying for Pakistan to selling to other countries. And those businessmen that he's working with start meeting with representatives of other countries. Khan meets with representatives of other countries. Some of his associates do. A number of other countries. The first deal we really know about in some detail is one with Iran in 1987, in which a group of businessmen meet in Dubai with Iranian representatives and offer to sell them some of those secret nuclear designs which Khan had first stolen from Europe in the 70s.
Pakistan's early nuclear research was done with the help of Libya, and the deal was cut between the heads of both countries, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto of Pakistan and Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. What was this deal? What was the arrangement?
Well, this came as in the early 70s, Pakistan was putting itself on the course of building a bomb. It needed money. Simple as that. Pakistan is a very poor country. And building a bomb, particularly at that point, was a hugely ambitious project and required millions, billions of dollars. And one of the places in which Pakistan went for money was Libya. Libya was at that time had just been taken over by Colonel Gaddafi. He was at that point in a very nationalist phase in which he was keen to assert Libyan power, in which the bomb, the nuclear bomb, was in his mind, in his description, the sword of Islam. And he saw an opportunity there by supporting Pakistan's scientific work and by delivering money. And so large shipments of money were basically flown from Libya to Pakistan to help finance the Pakistan program in the early days. Other money also came in from some of the Gulf states. Now, that didn't necessarily last for that long, but it did get the Pakistani program off the ground. And Libya then plays an important role later on in the Khan story.
What was the role?
Well, the role is that by the mid-1990s, Khan has been building up a bigger customer base for his bomb, and Libyans meet with Khan in a number of places, including Istanbul, in Casablanca, and basically the Libyans go to the Khan network looking for the bomb, and it is the biggest deal that the Khan network lands, far bigger than the other nuclear deals that they put together, because the Libyans at this point in the mid-1990s are asking for everything from Khan. They want a full turnkey program from start to finish, all the machines, the centrifuge machines required, designs, plans, machines to build more machines, if you like, everything. And this is the cause of the Khan network expanding in the late 90s to fulfill this deal. And that's important partly because it's the scale of that deal and the ambition of that deal which starts to draw attention from Western intelligence agencies that something's going on, and that in turn begins the downfall for AQ Khan.
Early on in Pakistan's development of its nuclear weapons program, how much did the United States know about it?
Well, actually, the United States knew quite a lot about Pakistan's early nuclear program. It knew that Pakistan wanted a bomb in the early 70s and that it was after one. It did think, however, that Pakistan was going down the plutonium route for the bomb rather than the uranium enrichment route. Two broad different ways of getting together the nuclear material. One is through nuclear reactors producing plutonium, which is then reprocessed. The other way is through uranium enrichment. The US thought that Pakistan was going down the plutonium route and tried to cut that off and stop it getting hold of reactors and reprocessing plants, which it succeeded in doing, actually. But the problem was that at the same time, Pakistan had a backup option, and that backup option was AQ Khan and his work on uranium enrichment technology and the designs he'd stolen from Europe. And so by the time that the US realized what Khan was doing and how important he was, it was effectively too late. By the late 70s, the US and the CIA realized that Khan was up to something. But then something very important happens, which is that in 1979, the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan. That makes Pakistan suddenly very important to the United States, because it's the base from which the US will fight a proxy war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, using the Mujahideen. And it needs Pakistani help to do that, to try and attack the Soviets. And so as a result, the US begins to turn a blind eye to that Pakistani bomb program during the 1980s.
In 1990, George H.W. Bush, President Bush, said that he could no longer certify that Pakistan didn't have the bomb. So what happened?
Well, this is after the Soviets have withdrawn from Afghanistan, so all of a sudden the US decides it doesn't need Pakistan much anymore, and basically cuts it loose and imposes sanctions on Pakistan over its nuclear program, finally in 1990, even though it had known for many years earlier that Pakistan was developing the bomb. It finally imposes those sanctions, and US-Pakistan relations dip precipitously, really, from then onwards through the 1990s, leaving the US with less leverage over Pakistan, leaving the Pakistanis looking elsewhere, for instance, for support. They needed a way to deliver the bomb, and so they started looking. The US had, as part of that 1990 sanctions imposition, had ended a deal to supply F-16 fighters So the Pakistanis began looking elsewhere, to China, to North Korea, for missile technology to deliver their bomb. So it did have, again, consequences by suddenly, abruptly ditching the Pakistanis. And also, I think it's important to say that that really did have quite a searing effect on Pakistan's psyche, of the elite in Pakistan and the leadership. That sense of having fought with the US in Afghanistan in the 80s and then suddenly being abandoned in 1990. And I think that's quite important to understand now, in terms of Pakistan still feeling that, OK, they're now an ally in the war on terror, but will they be ditched again as they were in the past?
Well, I think there's distrust on both ends, don't you think, in that relationship between the United States and Pakistan?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the Pakistanis basically played games with the US during the 1980s and played a double game, particularly over the nuclear program, and would say, oh, well, you know, we're not going to embarrass you, we're not going to do anything. But at the same time, pushing the US and were breaking some of the elements of the deal that they cut with the US administration over the nuclear program. So distrust, blame on both sides rather than just America. But I think it's that legacy of distrust on both sides, which is quite important for that relationship. It's a very, very strange and quite convulsive relationship between the US and Pakistan, where they go from periods of being close allies who need each other to being very distrustful almost overnight.
My guest is Cordon Carrera. His new book is called Shopping for Bombs: Nuclear Proliferation, Global Insecurity, and the Rise and Fall of the AQ Khan Network. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Cordon Carrera. His new book is called Shopping for Bombs, Nuclear Proliferation, Global Insecurity, and the Rise and Fall of the AQ Khan Network. Let's talk about AQ Khan's connections to Iran. But before we do, let's start talk about the very start of Iran's nuclear program, which was actually under the Shah of Iran. Why was the Shah, who was an ally of the United States, why was he pursuing a nuclear weapons program?
Well, this was in the mid-70s when the Shah suddenly talked about a huge expansion of nuclear technology. He talked about it in familiar terms about being about nuclear power rather than about nuclear weapons, although a lot of people suspected that that actually he was at least keeping the option open on developing a nuclear weapon. This was in the mid-1970s, in an era where a number of countries were looking at nuclear technology, looking at nuclear power and possibly nuclear weapons. Iran and Iraq were both in competition at this point about possibly going down that route and towards the bomb. And of course, the Shah also saw it in terms of prestige. So he did order a number of nuclear power plants, only one of which was started in Bushehr on the Gulf. But when the revolution came in 1979, the Iranian revolution, the new theocratic government decided it wanted nothing to do at that point with nuclear technology, and it saw it as something to do with the West and something un-Islamic. So initially abandoned the Shah's ambitions, at least for a few years.
And then?
Well, and then very quickly the Iran-Iraq war starts up after Iraq attacks Iran. And that war goes on and it becomes very bloody. And the Iraqis under Saddam Hussein begin to use chemical weapons against Iranian troops. So Iran decides that perhaps it needs to investigate unconventional weapons. It begins its own chemical program. And it begins to look once again in the mid-1980s, around 84, 85. It starts to look again at the nuclear option and at developing nuclear technology. Now, of course, Iran maintains now that this was always peaceful in intent, but it was definitely a secret program at this point to try and acquire nuclear technology.
How was Iran helped in its nuclear program by AQ Khan?
Well, the first deal comes in a Dubai hotel room in 1987, where some of Khan's business network meet with Iranian officials And for around $3 to $4 million, they hand over some of those incredibly valuable and sensitive designs for centrifuges that Khan had originally stolen in the 70s. Very advanced pieces of technology, very closely guarded secrets. And Khan hands them over to the Khan network hands them over to the Iranians at this point for the Iranians to work on. The Iranians initially go off and try and develop their own centrifuges and try and buy the parts, but they find it particularly difficult. It's not easy technology to do. So in the early 1990s, and around 1993, they come back into contact with the Khan network. And this time, rather than just buying designs, they buy designs and also parts and actual machines and centrifuge machines, which are used to enrich uranium. And that relationship really goes on until 1999 is the last known contact between the Khan network and the Iranians. So a very important set of contacts, which gave the Iranians a huge head start on their nuclear technology program. They really would be years behind without A.Q. Khan's assistance.
Now, you write that the International Atomic Energy Agency believes that the Khan deals with Iran in the 80s and 90s are key to understanding the Iranian nuclear program and whether it's a peaceful program in intent or military. Why are those deals key to understanding this?
Well, of course, the Iranians say their program is peaceful. But then people ask themselves, well, what were you doing dealing with the Khan network? And particularly with a Khan network, which was with Libya, selling not just nuclear technology, but nuclear weapons technology. For instance, to Libya, the Khan network gave an actual nuclear weapons design. And so one of the great questions about the Iran deals is whether A.Q. Khan also supplied Iran with nuclear weapons technology, the kind of technology which would only be used for weapons, as opposed to some of the centrifuge machines and other things which are dual use, if you like. You can use them for nuclear power or for nuclear weapons. And there are suspicions about this. There's no firm proof, we should say. But there are suspicions that the Iranians are hiding the full contours of their dealings with Khan, that there is more information about the deals they cut, about what they received, that they've never come clean on. One example is that very recently, International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors were in Iran and they found a set of documents on how to cast uranium metal into spheres. And this, it's argued, is something you only need to do if you're trying to make a bomb. There's no civilian use for this. And these were documents that came from the Khan network. And not just that, but look like the same, like they come from the same family of documents as those found in Libya, which relate to the nuclear weapons design. So the suspicion, and I should emphasise it's a suspicion, is that Khan supplied the Iranians with nuclear weapons information. But no one can prove that. And of course, that's very important to know, because it would be the definitive proof about whether what Iran's real intent was and remains.
You've spoken to a lot of people for your new book. How far along do you think Iran's nuclear weapons program is?
Well, I think one of the problems is that you see a lot of estimates about, well, is Iran 5 years from the bomb? Is Iran 10 years from the bomb? Is it 2 years from the bomb? And in my view, I think all of these are basically guesswork. And part of the reason they're guesswork is because we don't know exactly how much and what A.Q. Khan gave to Iran. And without knowing all those details, it's very, very hard to know how far Iran is along that route. One example is most of the technology around the uranium program is something called the P1 centrifuge, which is a design that Khan stole. But there's a more advanced thing called the P2 centrifuge. Now, Khan did give the Iranians some data on this, and he may have given them actual P2 machines, but no one knows that for sure. It's never been proven. Now, if the Iranians were able to put together these P2 machines and had some kind of secret program based on them, then they could move much faster towards the bomb than some of the estimates. But as I said, we don't know for sure the full contours of those deals. And without knowing that, it's very, very hard. I mean, I do think the Iranians are clearly struggling with some elements of the technology. So I think the evidence is that they're still struggling with some parts of uranium conversion and of enrichment and running these centrifuges. But I still think it's pretty difficult to come to a real estimate in terms of years, months, how far they are away from potentially having enough nuclear material for a bomb, if that's indeed what they want.
Since we're talking about Iran and its nuclear program here, I'm wondering what you think the repercussions would be if the Bush administration did decide to either bomb Iran's nuclear program or invade Iran in the hopes of bringing about regime change?
Well, I think an invasion is such a huge prospect that I think it's hard to imagine that anyone really thinks that's possible. I mean, given, if you just look at the geography of the place, it's a different scale even to Iraq. And if you look at the trouble that the US has had in occupying Iraq, I think you'd have to multiply that many times if you were going to think about an invasion of Iran and an occupation. So I think that really strikes me as incredibly unlikely or incredibly foolish if anyone really was thinking of that. Airstrikes, of course, on the nuclear facilities, on Natanz, where this Iranian centrifuge facility is being built. I mean, that's something which is clearly being left on the table by US policymakers. They don't want to take that off the table. Even with that, I think there are two questions. One, would it work? The answer is it might delay the Iranian program by a few years, but I think it may be impossible to destroy it and stop it completely. And secondly, what would be the consequences would be? Well, I think the problem is that the Iranians have many levers, if you like, in the region. They have a lot of leverage in Iraq, where they could cause a lot of problems for the US and its allies. They have they still have Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is a close ally of theirs. They also have the capability to carry out unconventional warfare or terrorist warfare around the world. They also have a lot of influence through the oil market and possibly closing the Straits of Hormuz. So I think the consequences of it do look quite serious if there was to be an airstrike. And as I said, it's not clear to me that it would necessarily succeed in permanently stopping the Iranian program, which isn't to say it won't happen, though.
Gordon Carrera is a security correspondent for the BBC. His new book about AQ Khan is called Shopping for Bombs. Carrera will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, working to make cancer a national priority at Celebration on the Hill. Details at acscan.org. And from Universal Pictures, presenting The Black Dahlia from the director of Scarface and the author of L.A. Confidential, The Black Dahlia, in theaters Friday. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how Libya's negotiations with the U.S. and England helped lead to the breakup of the AQ Khan network. We continue our conversation with Gordon Carrera. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Bob Dylan's new album. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Gordon Carrera, author of a new book about AQ Khan and his black market network that sold nuclear secrets and technology to any country willing to pay, including Iran, North Korea, and Libya. Since 2004, Khan has been under house arrest in his country, Pakistan, where many people consider him a hero for being the father of the country's nuclear bomb. Carrera is a security correspondent for the BBC TV and radio. His book is called Shopping for Bombs. In writing about AQ Khan, his network, and nuclear proliferation, you write a lot about Libya. Now, in December of 2003, Tony Blair and President Bush announced that Colonel Gaddafi had given up Libya's WMD program. And the Blair and Bush administrations described this as a victory in the war on terror and said that the invasion of Iraq had paved the way for this. What have you learned about what happened behind the scenes in this deal?
Well, this is something that I found absolutely fascinating. I spend a lot of time on it. It's actually what really got me interested in this subject was watching in December 2003 this declaration by the Libyans that they were giving up a nuclear weapons program, which actually no one knew that they had. And I remember thinking, well, you know, where did that come from? How did it happen? And so I spent a lot of time trying to uncover both the Libyan motivation and the process by which the negotiations took place, which led to that Libyan renunciation. In terms of the Libyan motivation, I think actually Colonel Gaddafi was pursuing a quite interesting dual-track strategy from the 1990s. His overriding motivation was to stay in power, was to preserve his regime. And at the same time, he was pursuing the bomb, trying to buy one off AQ Khan, and at the same time trying to cut a deal and open up relations with the US and the UK. And he was basically pursuing both tracks at the same time, seeing which one, if you like, would work and which one would be successful. And by 2003, by March 2003, he clearly felt that the bomb was going slowly, but that the threat, if you like, from the US and the UK was still there, and that it was more important to cut a deal. So in March 2003, an intermediary called British intelligence MI6 headquarters and said Colonel Gaddafi's son, in fact, wanted to meet senior MI6 officers, and he wanted to talk, and he was willing to put everything on the table. And that began a process of negotiations. For a couple of days later, a senior MI6 officer went and flew to Libya to meet with Colonel Gaddafi. And it began a very tortuous actual period of negotiations over months, very secretive. No one knew anything about it, to try and work out what the Libyans were up to. And I do think that timing is quite important, because March 2003, of course, is exactly the time when the war with Iraq started. And I do think that Iraq was an accelerant to Colonel Gaddafi's motivation, to his decision to give up his weapons program, because I do think he feared being next to some extent. But he then seemed to back off slightly, wasn't owning up about everything, and it became a very difficult and complex intelligence operation, negotiation, to force his hand eventually and get him to own up to everything and come clean and make that decision. And in the process, that led to the wrapping up of the Khan network.
Yes, before we get to that, you say that Libya approached the United States before it approached England and said that it wanted to make a deal, but that the United States ignored Libya. How come?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, if you go back, actually, the Libyans were trying to make approaches back to the early 90s. The first one I found was to Gary Hart, actually, in 1992. And it made further contacts through the 90s. In 1999, there were negotiations. But actually, during this period, the US wasn't particularly interested in cutting a deal with Libya. It didn't know much about its nuclear program during the 90s. And so didn't really think it was something, didn't really see the incentive in talking and cutting a deal, and just saw Gaddafi as a kind of rogue state. Basically, there was a lot of miscommunication, a lot of mistrust. Some of the negotiations over Lockerbie, the downing of the Pan Am jet over Lockerbie, was still going on, and compensation for that. And so there just doesn't seem to have been any kind of communication and proper communication between the two sides, whereas the UK did open up some kind of diplomatic relations with Libya. And so I think the Libyans saw the UK as a means, a better negotiating partner, and a means, if you like, of approaching the US, but using the UK partly as an intermediary.
So when Libya offered to get rid of its WMD program, what did it get in exchange from Britain and the United States?
Well, this is one of the really interesting things, is the US was adamant during the discussions that these discussions weren't negotiations. Robert Joseph was very involved in them, who was then at the White House and who's now Undersecretary of State for Arms Control. And during a lot of these negotiations, which he was involved in, he and others never wanted to give the impression that there was a deal, that it would be a case of Libya renouncing its WMD and in return it would get normalisation of relations. Because, of course, the ideology of the Bush administration has been, we don't negotiate with rogue states, we take a tough line and then they decide what to do. And so they were always very careful in these discussions to say, you give up your program and then, you know, we'll see what happens, but you can see that something good will happen. Now, of course, in practice, they were negotiations, and in practice, there were pretty clear incentives in terms of improving relations. So in the end, what the Libyans hoped and expected was approval, if you like, initially from President Bush and Tony Blair, but also eventually a normalisation of relations. And interestingly enough, it actually took a couple of years for them to get that. It was only, I think, earlier this year, in spring of this year, that finally the US agreed to fully normalize diplomatic relations with Libya and bring it out of the cold.
So did the negotiations between the United States, America, and Libya help lead to AQ Khan's capture?
Absolutely. During those negotiations, a ship was raided in the Mediterranean carrying some of the parts that AQ Khan was shipping to Libya. The ship was called the BBC China, and that provided evidence. More evidence came when Libya gave up its program. Some evidence was also starting to come out of Iran and inspections in Iran about what AQ Khan had supplied. And so the pressure was building on AQ Khan and on Pakistan and President Musharraf to deal with him. But it was still a very difficult process, and President Musharraf found it very hard to stop Khan, to put him out of business. He tried once in 2001 to sideline him, but that never put him out of business, and AQ Khan was still left operating. And part of the problem was that AQ Khan was a national hero in Pakistan, precisely because he delivered the bomb to Pakistan. He was seen by the general public as having delivered security to his country, and in many ways was far more popular than any politician, including President Musharraf. And so it was a real challenge for President Musharraf to deal with it. But the pressure was growing, and in New York, President Musharraf was confronted by President Bush and CIA Director George Tenet, saying, "You've got to deal with it. Look at the evidence." That was in September. Then in December of 2003, Libya renounced its program again, pointing the finger at AQ Khan. And the pressure began to grow. And finally, it took actually a phone call from then US Secretary of State Colin Powell to President Musharraf to actually force Musharraf finally to act against Khan.
Was there some kind of deal made between America and Pakistan before Musharraf agreed to arrest Khan?
Well, there wasn't. I'm not sure if I'd call it a deal. There were some tough words. Colin Powell called up President Musharraf and said that President Bush was about to go and make a speech in a few days' time about Libya, about nuclear technology, and was going to name Khan, and that if President Musharraf hadn't dealt with AQ Khan, it would be pretty embarrassing. That really put pressure on Pakistan to finally stop him. But then there was some pretty intensive negotiations within Pakistan about what to do with AQ Khan. And basically, AQ Khan cut a deal with the Pakistani government. And the deal was pretty straightforward. It was Khan would confess. He would confess what he'd done. But in return, he'd receive a pardon. He wouldn't be put on trial. He would also be put under house arrest in Islamabad, but he wouldn't be handed over to the United States. And this was the deal that Khan and his supporters cut with President Musharraf, and which still to some extent holds in place to this day. And the Americans basically were forced to live with that deal, even though I think they would have liked a bit more, but they were just primarily focused on putting Khan out of business.
What they'd really like is to interrogate him, but they can't.
Absolutely. I think that's no doubt what they'd like to do is to sit down with AQ Khan and say to him, so what did you supply to Iran? What did you give them and when? How much help did you give them? What did they talk to you about in terms of nuclear technology and nuclear weapons? That's what the CIA would like to do, but it can't, and it's been refused direct access as part of this deal that AQ Khan cut with President Musharraf. Now, why could he cut a deal? Well, the answer, which seems to be the case, is that Khan had a lot of information about who in Pakistan might have known about what he was up to, about who might have supported him, who might have funded him, who might have which figures in the army might have known about his deals. All that information was Khan's insurance policy to some extent, and was pretty useful in making sure that he wouldn't be handed over, precisely for fear that he would hand over some pretty embarrassing information as well to the Americans about Pakistan.
My guest is Gordon Carrera. His new book is called Shopping for Bombs, Nuclear Proliferation, Global Insecurity, and the Rise and Fall of the AQCon Network. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Gordon Carrera. He's the author of the new book, Shopping for Bombs, Nuclear Proliferation, Global Insecurity, and the Rise and Fall of the AQCon Network. One of the conclusions you reach in your book, after writing about AQCon and nuclear proliferation, is that the non-proliferation system is basically out of date and we need to re-examine it. What parts of the system do you think aren't working anymore?
Well, I think the non-proliferation system is based around the non-proliferation treaty, and that's based around a pretty simple deal. And the deal is that the countries with nuclear weapons would agree to negotiate in good faith to disarm themselves. The countries without nuclear weapons would agree not to seek weapons and in return would receive civilian nuclear technology for power from the nuclear haves, the countries with nuclear weapons. That was the deal, and that deal kind of held, but it's increasingly breaking down, and trust between, if you like, the haves and have-nots is increasingly collapsing. Why? Well, the have-nots say, well, the nuclear club have refused to disarm, they've refused to devalue nuclear weapons, they're looking at developing new nuclear weapons, so they haven't fulfilled that part of the deal. The nuclear club look at some of the countries and look at the deal and say, well, look at the Iranians, they're abusing the system by saying they're going for civilian nuclear power when in fact they're going for nuclear weapons, so they don't have much faith in the deal and the system. And so both sides, if you like, are stepping back from that deal and that system, and the values underpinning it are collapsing. And the best really example of that is that every 5 years the NPT is supposed to be reviewed. And the last time in 2005, they couldn't even agree on an agenda, let alone how to review the treaty. So I think that's a sign that the treaty really is in problems.
A lot of people say countries like the United States have a double standard. India has the bomb. India's our ally. We like India. No problem. Iran has a nuclear program that may or may not be a weapons program, and that's a real problem. So, because we don't like Iran's regime. So how do you think that what is perceived as a double standard is affecting the nuclear non-proliferation system?
Well, I think this is important because I think it is part of the collapse of the non-proliferation system and of the consensus which underpins it. And as I said earlier, I think you have the US basically stepping away from the NPT and saying, we are going to decide for ourselves which states we feel comfortable about with nuclear technology and nuclear weapons and which ones we don't. And so you have Iran, which is a member of the NPT, being put under pressure by the United States, and you have India, which isn't a member at all and which stands outside it and has the bomb, being basically legitimised. Now, you could argue that that's actually very sensible because India is a very different state to Iran and has different strategic interests and a different relationship with the United States. And that's all true. But the problem is it undermines any sense of global values or universal values or a system. And that is perhaps the concern, is that if there is no system, then it becomes a bit of a free-for-all with the US enforcing its power where it wants. Now, as I said, that may be the only option in the US eyes. If the system has already collapsed, then you've got to find a new way of dealing with aspiring nuclear weapons countries or aspiring nuclear countries. But I think it does make it harder then to draw other countries in support of your policy and to build a consensus, for instance, to take action on Iran if other countries are suspicious of your policy or believe that you don't have any kind of universal approach to this problem.
Israel has a nuclear weapon. Where does it fit in terms of the international community stand on non-proliferation?
Well, Israel is outside of the non-proliferation treaty, a bit like India and Pakistan. It's not part of that system. And the problem is that the Israeli bomb being outside of that system is the subject of much complaint from many countries who talk about double standards and why, for instance, the US is so bothered about Iran but doesn't worry about Israel. I mean, obviously, people say different countries mean you have to have different attitudes towards them because of the different ambitions of those countries. It does complicate matters, I think, but clearly Israel feels it does need it for its own security and to protect it against destruction or annihilation, which, after all, is something which the president of Iran has recently been talking about.
Have you heard any interesting proposal for how the international community could deal with nuclear proliferation now? Something like an alternative to the problems with the nuclear proliferation treaty?
I mean, some of the solutions really that have been offered really do go back to the start of this whole non-proliferation system in the 50s when President Eisenhower talked about atoms for peace. And the question about whether you could create a kind of an international bank or repository for nuclear material so that countries like, for instance, Iran or other countries which say they want nuclear fuel for nuclear power could draw on that bank but wouldn't need to actually have the nuclear technology in their own country. Because the primary problem is that the same enrichment technology that Khan was selling, that Iran is developing, can be used to produce nuclear fuel for nuclear power or nuclear weapons material. And it's pretty much the same technology. And so one of the proposals is, do you kind of internationalize the system of providing nuclear fuel and place it in international hands, and then you can supply it to countries, and there's no danger of them diverting it towards weapons.
Did you meet anyone or talk to anyone in the AQ Khan network?
I did, yes. I met some businessmen who had been involved in it. I met one British businessman who was involved as a supplier to Khan, although he is adamant that he was never involved in actually knowingly supplying anything towards a nuclear weapons program and that everything he did was legal. But it was very interesting to try and understand some of the way in which the motivations behind some of these businessmen and why they were supplying Khan and other countries, and also gave you a real insight into the way Khan operated, and also how some of the Western countries approached businessmen and suppliers.
Were their motivations anything beyond business and money?
Primarily business and money, exactly. But they often tried to cloak it in terms of some kind of justification. One of the things that this businessman said to me was that, well, you know, spreading the bomb isn't a problem because the more countries having the bomb means they won't go to war with each other. It's like deterrence in the Cold War. There's no danger. So actually, the more you spread the bomb, the safer the world will be. Now, I have trouble with that theory because I think particularly in an unstable world, I think that's not necessarily the case. And actually, some of these countries could use the bomb, and India and Pakistan came close to using it a couple of times in the last decade. But that's one of the justifications they come up with.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gordon Carrera is a security correspondent for the BBC. His new book about AQ Khan is called Shopping for Bombs. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Bob Dylan's new album. This is Fresh Air. Bob Dylan's new album, Modern Times, hit the top of the record charts last week. Now 65, the singer-songwriter continues to explore blues and older pop styles with lyrics that frequently contain contemporary references. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Today's the day you're gonna grab my trombone. Well, it's hot stuff here, and it's everywhere I go. I was thinking about Alicia Keys. Couldn't keep
Bob Dylan is thinking of Alicia Keys? Why? As he told the novelist Jonathan Lethem in Rolling Stone magazine, he saw her on TV and thought to himself, there's nothing about that girl I don't like. At any rate, much like the novelist Philip Roth, Dylan is a senior citizen artist working at full power, sly, randy, grumpy, creatively vindictive, never resigned to the hypocrisy and false piety he sees and hears all around him.
There's an evening haze settling over town, starlight by the edge of the creek. The buying power of the proletariat's gone down, money's getting shallow and weak. Well, the place I love best is a sweet memory, it's a new path that we trod. They say low wages are reality if we want to compete abroad. My cruel weapons have been put on the shelf. Come sit down on my knee. You are dearer to me than myself, as you yourself can see. While I'm listening to the steel rails hum, got both eyes tight shut, just sitting here trying to keep the hunger from creeping its way into my gut. Meet me at the bottom, don't lag behind. Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working man blues.
That's Working Man's Blues number 2, Dylan's oblique answer record to Merle Haggard's 1969 hit. Haggard has been an opening act on parts of the never-ending tour. Dylan does more than merely riff off the title. He tosses out lines like, the power of the proletariat's gone down, and they say low wages are a reality if we want to compete abroad, in a way that leaves you feeling like you've been sliced with a knife but didn't feel the blade go in. Acting like he has nothing to lose while thinking through songs as though his continued health depended on it, Dylan is nothing if not an immensely satisfying old smoothie these days.
Spirit on the water. Darkness on the face of the deep. I keep thinking about you, baby, and I can't hardly sleep. I'm traveling by land, traveling through the dawn of the day. You're always on my mind.
That's a great Bob Dylan performance. The way he croons and mutters the words, phrasing conversationally all around a lovely melody, that's a tight little piece of country blues rhythm you can dance to. On another song here, The Levee's Gonna Break, Dylan speaks of people fleeing a rising tide, not merely with no possessions, but with, quote, barely enough skin to cover their bones. Yet the jaunty music that makes Dylan's song so effective isn't scary or solemn. Solemnity is something Bob Dylan has utterly no use for these days.
If it keep on raining, the levee gonna break. If it keep on raining, the levee gonna break. Everybody saying this is a day only the Lord could make. Well, I worked on the levee, mama, both night and day. I worked on the levee, mama, both night and day. I got to the river and I threw my clothes away. I paid my time and now I'm as good as new. I paid my time and now I'm as good as new. They can't take me back unless I want them to. They better keep on raining, the levee gonna break. If it keep on raining, the levee gonna break. Some of these people gonna strip you of all they can take.
Like all the songs here, no matter what their putative subject matter is, they all boil down to one of that song's final lines. "I'd try to get you to love me, but I ain't gonna repeat that mistake." Women who've loved him, wronged him, turned him on, and turned him off take up a lot of psychic and musical space here. Dylan breaks with any chronological analysis of his work. He could have recorded half of this stuff right after he cut the "How Does It Feel" chorus of Like a Rolling Stone 31 years ago. As a master of time and space, he knows that living in the present is the best idea a fella can have. Or as he puts it elsewhere, "I can't go to paradise. I killed a man back there."
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. On this fifth anniversary of September 11th, we'll close with Charlie Hayden playing America the Beautiful.
Support for NPR comes from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. From Universal Pictures, presenting The Black Dahlia, from the director of Scarface and the author of L.A. Confidential, The Black Dahlia, in theaters Friday. And from Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start October 2nd. At capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, corporate greed and abuse in the reconstruction of Iraq. We talk with LA Times investigative reporter T. Christian Miller about his new book, Blood Money. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.